Though he patted his sister's hand and maintained his good humor for the benefit of the others, Gurney knew the troopers needed few excuses to take more captives. Brilliant spotlights targeted the village. Dark, armored forms rushed up the packed dirt streets, pounding on houses. Then the door to the communal building was shouldered open with a loud crash. Six men strode inside. Gurney recognized Captain Kriubi of the Baronial Guard, the man in charge of House Harkonnen security. "Stand still for inspection," Kriubi ordered. A shard of mustache bristled on his lip. His face was narrow and his cheeks looked sunken, as if he clenched his jaw too often. Gurney remained by the window. "We've done nothing wrong here, Captain. We follow Harkonnen rules. We do our work." Kriubi looked over at him. "And who appointed you the leader of this village?" Gurney did not think fast enough to keep his sarcasm in check. "And who gave you orders to harass innocent villagers? You'll make us incapable of doing our tasks tomorrow." His companions in the tavern were horrified at his impudence. Beth clutched Gurney's hand, trying to keep her brother quiet. The Harkonnen guards made threatening gestures with their weapons. Gurney jerked his chin to indicate the prisoner escort vehicle outside the window. "What did those people do? What crimes worthy of arrest?" "No crimes are necessary," Kriubi said, coolly unafraid of the truth. Gurney took a step forward, but three guards grasped his arms and threw him heavily to the floor. He knew the Baron often recruited guards from the farming villages. The new thugs, rescued from bleak lives and given new uniforms, weapons, lodgings, and women, often became scornful of their previous lives and proved crueler than off-world professionals. Gurney hoped he would recognize a man from a neighboring village, so he could spit in his eye. His head struck the hard floor, but he sprang back to his feet. Beth moved quickly to her brother's side.
"Don't provoke them any more."
It was the worst thing she could have done. Kriubi pointed at her. "All right, take that one too." Beth's narrow face paled when two of the three guards grabbed her by her thin arms. She struggled as they hauled her to the still-open door. Gurney cast his balisette aside and lunged forward, but the remaining guard produced his weapon and brought the butt down hard across the young man's forehead and nose. Gurney staggered, then threw himself forward again, swinging balled fists like mallets. "Leave her alone!" He knocked one of the guards down and tore the second one away from his sister. She screamed as the three converged upon Gurney, pummeling him, slamming their weapons so brutally into him that his ribs cracked. His nose was already bloodied. "Help me!" Gurney shouted to the saucer-eyed villagers. "We outnumber the bastards!" No one came to his aid. He flailed and punched, but went down in a flurry of kicking boots and pounding weapons. Struggling to lift his head, he saw Kriubi watching as his men pulled Beth toward the door. Gurney pushed, trying to throw off the heavy men who held him down. Between the gauntleted arms and padded legs, he saw the villagers frozen in their seats, like sheep. They watched him with stricken expressions, but remained as motionless as stones in a castle keep.
"Help me, damn you!"
One guard punched him in the solar plexus, making him gasp and retch. Gurney's voice was gone, his breath fading. Black spots danced in front of his eyes. Finally, the guards withdrew. He propped himself on an elbow just in time to see Beth's despairing face as the Harkonnen men dragged her into the night. Enraged and frustrated, he swayed back to his feet, fighting to remain conscious. He heard the prison transport power up in the square outside. Haloed by a glow of illumination against the windows of the tavern, it roared off toward another village to pick up more captives. Gurney blinked at the other men through swollen eyes. Strangers. He coughed and spat blood, then wiped it from his lips. Finally, when he could wheeze, he said, You bastards just sat there. You didn't lift a finger to help. Brushing himself off, he glared at the villagers. How can you let them do this to us? They took my sister. But they were no better than sheep, and never had been. He should have expected nothing different now. With utter contempt, he spat blood and saliva on the floor, then staggered toward the door and out. Secrets are an important aspect of power. The effective leader spreads them in order to keep men in line. Prince Raphael Corino, Discourses on Leadership in a Galactic Imperium, 12th edition. The ferret-faced man stood like a spying crow on the second level of the residency at Arrakeen. He gazed down into the spacious atrium.
You are certain they know about our little soiree, huh?
His lips were cracked from the dry air. They had been that way for years.
All the invitations personally delivered, all the populace notified?
Count Hasimir Fenring leaned toward the slender, loose-chinned chief of his guard force, Geraldo Willowbrook, who stood beside him. The scarlet and gold-uniformed man nodded, squinted in the bright light that streamed through prismatic, shield-reinforced windows.
It will be a grand celebration for your anniversary here, sir. Already beggars are massing at the front gate.
Good, very good. My wife will be pleased.
On the main floor below, a chef carried a silver coffee service toward the kitchen. Cooking odors drifted upward, exotic soups and sauces prepared for the evening's extravagant festivities, broiled brochettes of meat from animals that had never lived on Arrakis. Fenring gripped a carved ironwood banister. An arched Gothic ceiling rose two stories overhead, with ilaca wood crossbeams and plaz skylights. Though muscular, he was not a large man, and found himself dwarfed by the immensity of this house. He'd commissioned the ceiling himself, and another in the dining hall. The new East Wing was his concept as well, with its elegant guest rooms and opulent private pools. In his decade as Imperial Observer on the desert planet, he had generated a constant buzz of construction around him. Following his exile from Shaddam's court on Kaitain, he'd had to make his mark somehow. From the botanical conservatory under construction near the private chambers he shared with Lady Margaret, he heard the hum of power tools along with the chants of day labor crews. They cut keyhole-arched doorways, set dry fountains into alcoves, adorned walls with colorful geometric mosaics. For luck, one of the hinges supporting a heavy ornamental door had been symbolically shaped as the hand of Fatima, beloved daughter of an ancient prophet of old Terra. Fenring was about to dismiss Willowbrook when a resounding crash made the upper floor shudder. The two men ran down the curving hallway past bookcases. From rooms and lift tubes, curious household servants poked their heads into the corridor. The oval conservatory door stood open, revealing a mass of tangled metal and plaz. One of the workers shouted for medics over the din of screaming. A fully laden suspensor scaffold had collapsed. Fenring vowed to personally administer the appropriate punishment, once an investigation had pointed fingers at the likely scapegoats. Shouldering his way into the room, Fenring looked up. Through the open metal framing of the arched roof, he saw a lemon-yellow sky. Only a few of the filter glass windows had been installed. Others now lay shattered in the tangle of scaffolding. He spoke in a tone of disgust.
Unfortunate timing, I was going to take our guests on a tour tonight.
Yes, most unfortunate, Count Fenring, sir.
Willowbrook watched while household workers began digging in the rubble to reach the injured. House medics in khaki uniforms hurried past him into the ruined area. One tended a bloody-faced man who had just been pulled from the debris. while two men helped remove a heavy sheet of plaz from additional victims. The job superintendent had been crushed by the fallen scaffold. Stupid fellow, Fenring thought. But lucky, considering what I'd have done to him for this mess. Fenring glanced at his wrist chron. 2 more hours until the guests arrived. He motioned to Willowbrook. Wrap it up here. I don't want any noise coming from this area during the party. That would provide entirely the wrong message, hmm? Lady Margaret and I have laid out the evening's festivities most carefully, down to the last detail. Willowbrook scowled, but obviously thought better of showing defiance. It will be done, sir, in less than an hour. Fenring simmered. In reality, he cared nothing for exotic plants, and initially had agreed to this expensive remodeling only as a concession to his Bene Gesserit wife, the Lady Margaret. Although she'd requested only a modest airlocked room with plants inside, Fenring, ever ambitious, had expanded it to something far more impressive. He conceived plans to collect rare flora from all over the Imperium. If ever the conservatory could be finished. Composing himself, he greeted Margaret in the vaulted entry just as she returned from the labyrinthine souk markets in town. A willowy blonde with gray-green eyes, perfect figure, and impeccable features, she stood nearly a head taller than he. She wore an Abba robe tailored to show off her figure, the black fabric speckled with dust from the streets. "Did they have Ikazi turnips, my dear?" The Count stared hungrily at 2 heavy packages wrapped in thick brown spice paper carried by male servants. Having heard of a merchant's arrival by highliner that afternoon, Margaret had hurried into Arakeen to purchase the scarce vegetables. He tried to peek under the paper wrappings, but she playfully slapped his hand away. "Is everything ready here, my dear?" "Mm-hmm. It's all going smoothly," he said. "We can't tour your new conservatory tonight, though. It's too messy up there for our dinner guests." Waiting to greet the important guests as they arrived at sunset, Lady Margaret Fenring stood in the mansion's atrium, adorned on its wood-paneled lower level with portraits of Padishah emperors extending back to the legendary General Faycon Corin, who had fought in the Butlerian Jihad, and the enlightened ruler Crown Prince Raphael Corino, as well as the hunter Fondil III, and his son Elrud IX. In the center of the atrium, a golden statue showed the current Emperor Shaddam IV in full Sardaukar regalia with a ceremonial sword raised high. It was one of many expensive works the Emperor had commissioned in the first decade of his reign. Around the residency and grounds were numerous additional examples, gifts from her husband's boyhood friend. Although the two men had quarreled at the time of Shaddam's ascension to the throne, they had gradually grown closer again. Through the dust-sealed double doors streamed elegantly dressed ladies, accompanied by men in raven-like post-Butlerian tuxedos and military uniforms of varying colors. Margaret herself wore a floor-length gown of silk taffeta with emerald shimmer sequins on the bodice. As a uniformed crier announced her guests, Margaret greeted them. They filed past into the grand hall, where she heard much laughter, conversation, and clinking of glasses. Entertainers from House Jongleur performed tricks and sang witty songs to celebrate the Fenring's 10 years on Arrakis. Her husband strutted down the grand staircase from the second floor. Count Fenring wore a dark blue retro tuxedo with a crimson royal sash across the chest, personally tailored for him on Bifkar. She bent to allow the shorter man to kiss her on the lips. "Now go in and welcome our guests, dear, before the Baron dominates every conversation." With a light step, Fenring avoided an intent, frumpy-looking duchess from one of the Corino sub-planets. The duchess passed a remote-cast poison snooper over her wine glass before drinking, then slipped the device unobtrusively into a pocket of her ball gown. Margaret watched her husband as he went to the fireplace to talk with Baron Harkonnen, current holder of the Siridar Fief of Arrakis and its rich spice monopoly. The light of a blazing fire enhanced by hearth prisms gave the Baron's puffy features an eerie cast. He wasn't looking at all well. In the years she and Fenring had been stationed there, the Baron had invited them to dine at his keep or attend gladiatorial events featuring slaves from Gedi Prime. He was a dangerous man who thought too much of himself. Now the Baron leaned on a gilded walking stick whose head had been designed to resemble the mouth of a great sandworm of Arrakis. Margaret had seen the Baron's health decline dramatically over the past decade. He suffered from a mysterious muscular and neurological malady that had caused him to gain weight. From her Bene Gesserit sisters, she knew the reason for his physical discomfiture, how it had been inflicted upon him when he'd raped Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam. The Baron, however, had never learned the cause of his distress. Mohiam herself, another carefully selected guest for this event, passed into Margaret's line of sight. The gray-haired Reverend Mother wore a formal Abba robe with a diamond-crusted collar. She smiled a tight-lipped greeting. With a subtle flicker of fingers, she sent a message and a question. "What news for Mother Superior Harishka? Give details. I must report to her." Margaret's fingers responded. "Progress on the Missionaria Protectiva matter. Only rumors, nothing confirmed. Missing sisters not yet located. Long time. They may all be dead." Mohiam did not look pleased. She herself had once worked with the Missionaria Protectiva, an invaluable Bene Gesserit division that sowed infectious superstitions on far-flung worlds. Mohiam had spent decades here in her younger years, posing as a town woman, disseminating information, enhancing superstitions that might benefit the sisterhood. Mohiam herself had never been able to infiltrate the closed Freeman Society. But over the centuries, many other sisters had gone into the deep desert to mingle with the Freeman, and had disappeared. Since she was on Arrakis as the Count's consort, Margaret had been asked to confirm the Missionaria's subtle work. Thus far, she'd heard unconfirmed reports of reverend mothers who had joined the Freeman and gone underground, as well as rumors of Bene Gesserit-like religious rituals among the tribes. One isolated siege supposedly had a holy woman. Dusty travelers were overheard in a town coffee tent, speaking of a messiah legend clearly inspired by the Panoplia Propheticus. But none of this information came directly from the Freeman themselves. The desert people, like their planet, seemed impenetrable. Maybe the Freeman murdered the Bene Gesserit women outright and stole the water from their bodies. "Those others have been swallowed up by the sands." Margaret's fingers flickered. "Nevertheless, find them." With a nod that ended the silent conversation, Mohiam glided across the room toward a side doorway. "Rondo Tuek," the crier announced, "the water merchant." Turning, Margaret saw a broad-faced but wiry man stride across the foyer with an odd rolling gait. He had tufts of rusty gray hair at the sides of his head, thinning strands on his pate, and widely separated gray eyes. She reached out to greet him.
"Ah, yes, the smuggler."
Tuek's flat cheeks darkened. Then a broad smile cracked his squarish face. He wagged a finger at her, in the manner of a teacher to a student. "I am a water supplier who works hard to excavate moisture from the dirty ice caps."
"Without the industriousness of your family, I'm sure the Imperium would collapse."
"My lady is too kind." Tuek bowed and entered the grand hall. Outside the residency, poor beggars had gathered, hoping for a rare show of graciousness from the Count. Other spectators had come to watch the beggars and gaze longingly up at the ornate facade of the mansion. Water sellers in brightly dyed traditional garb jingled their bells and called out an eerie cry of "Su-su-suk!" Guards, borrowed from the Harkonnen troops and obliged to wear imperial uniforms for the event, stood by the doorways, keeping out undesirables and clearing the way for the invited. It was a circus. When the last of the expected guests arrived, Margaret glanced at an antique chrono set into the wall, adorned with mechanical figures and delicate chimes. They were nearly half an hour late. She hurried to her husband's side and whispered in his ear. He dispatched a messenger to the jongleurs, and they fell silent, a signal familiar to the guests.
"May I have your attention, please,
Fenring shouted. Pompously dressed footmen appeared to escort the attendees.
"We will reconvene in the dining hall."
According to tradition, Count and Countess Fenring trailed behind the last of their guests. On either side of the wide doorway to the dining hall stood laving basins of gold-embedded tile, decorated with intricate mosaics containing the crests of House Corino and House Harkonnen, in accordance with political necessity. The crest denoting the previous governors of Arrakis, House Richies, had been painstakingly chiseled out to be replaced with a blue Harkonnen griffin. The guests paused at the basins, dipped their hands into the water, and slopped some onto the floor. After drying their hands, they flung towels into a growing puddle. Baron Harkonnen had suggested this custom to show that a planetary governor cared nothing for water shortages. It was an optimistic flaunting of wealth. Fenring had liked the sound of that, and the procedure had been instituted. With a benevolent twist, however, Lady Margaret saw a way to help the beggars in a largely symbolic way. With her husband's grudging concurrence, she let it be known that, at the conclusion of each banquet, beggars were welcome to gather outside the mansion and receive any water that could be squeezed from the soiled towels. Her hands tingling and damp, Margaret entered the long hall with her husband. Antique tapestries adorned the walls. Free-floating glow globes wandered around the room, all set at the same height above the floor, all tuned to the yellow band. Over the polished wooden table hung a chandelier of glittering blue-green Hagel quartz, with a sensitive poison snooper concealed in the upper reaches of the chain. A small army of footmen held chairs for the diners and draped a napkin over each guest's lap. Someone stumbled and knocked a crystal centerpiece to the floor, where it shattered. Servants hurried to clean it up and replace it. Everyone else pretended not to notice. Margaret, seated at the foot of the long table, nodded graciously to planetologist Pardit Kynes and his 12-year-old son, who took their assigned seats on either side of her. She'd been surprised when the rarely seen desert man accepted her invitation, and she hoped to learn how many of the rumors about him were true. In her experience, dinner parties were notorious for small talk and insincerity, though certain things did not escape the attention of an astute Bene Gesserit observer. She watched the lean man carefully, noting a repair patch on the gray collar of his dress tunic, and the strong line of his sandy bearded jaw. Two places down from her, Reverend Mother Mohiam slid into a chair. Hasimir Fenring took his seat at the head of the table, with Baron Harkonnen on his right. Knowing how the Baron and Mohiam loathed one another, Margaret had seated them far apart. At a snap of Fenring's fingers, servants bearing platters of exotic morsels emerged from side doorways. They worked their way around the table, identifying the fare and serving sample portions from the plates.
"Thank you for inviting us, Lady Fenring," Kynes's son said, looking at Margaret.
The planetologist had introduced the young man as Waichi, a name that meant beloved. She could see a resemblance to the father,
but while the older kinds had a dreaminess in his eyes, this Weichi bore a hardness caused by growing up on Arrakis. She smiled at him. One of our chefs is a city freeman who has prepared a Siege specialty for the banquet, spice cakes with honey and sesame.
Freeman cuisine is imperial class now? Pardit Kynes inquired with a wry smile.
He looked as if he'd never thought of food as anything more than sustenance, and considered formal dining to be a distraction from other work.
Cuisine is a matter of taste.
She selected her words diplomatically. Her eyes twinkled.
I take that as a no, he said.
Tall, off-world serving women moved from place to place with narrow-necked bottles of blue mélange-laced wine. To the amazement of the locals, plates of whole fish appeared, surrounded by gaping bazelle mussels. Even the wealthiest inhabitants of Arrakeen rarely sampled seafood.
Ah,
Fenring said with delight from the other end of the table, as a servant lifted a cover from a tray.
I shall relish these Akazi turnips,
Thank you, my dear.
The servant ladled dark sauce onto the vegetables.
No expense is too great for our honored guests, Margaret said.
Let me tell you why those vegetables are so expensive, a diplomat from Ekaz groused, commanding everyone's attention.
Bindik Narvi was a small man with a deep, thundering voice.
Crop sabotage has drastically reduced our supply for the entire Imperium. We've named this new scourge the Grumman Blight.
He glared across the table at the ambassador from Grumman, a huge, heavy-drinking man with creased, dark skin.
We have also discovered biological sabotage in our fog tree forests on the continent of Alaka.
All of the Imperium-prized Akazi fog tree sculptures, which were made by directing growth through the power of human thought. Despite his bulk, the Mauritani man, Lupino Ord, spoke in a squeaky voice.
Once again, the Akazis fake a shortage to drive prices up, an ancient trick that has been around since your thieving ancestors were driven from old Terra in disgrace.
That isn't what happened at all.
Gentlemen, please, Fenring said.
The Grummans had always been a very volatile people, ready to fly into a vengeful frenzy at the slightest perceived insult. Fenring found it all rather thin-skinned and boring. He looked at his wife.
Did we make a mistake in the seating arrangement, my dear?
Or perhaps in the guest list, she quipped. Polite, embarrassed laughter bubbled around the table. The quarreling men grew quiet, though they glared at one another.
So nice to see that our eminent planetologist has brought along his fine young son, Baron Harkonnen said in an oily tone. Quite a handsome lad. You have the distinction of being the youngest dinner guest.
I am honored to be here, the boy replied, among such esteemed company.
Being groomed to succeed your father, I hear, the Baron continued.
Margaret detected carefully hidden sarcasm in the basso voice.
I don't know what we'd do without a planetologist.
In truth, Kynes was rarely seen in the city, and almost never submitted the required reports to the Emperor. Not that Shaddam noticed or cared. Margaret had gleaned from her husband that the Emperor was occupied with other, as yet unrevealed, matters. The young man's intent eyes brightened. He raised a water flagon.
May I propose a toast to our host and hostess?
Pardit Kynes blinked at his son's boldness, as if surprised that the social nicety had not occurred to him first.
An excellent suggestion, the Baron gushed.
Margaret recognized the slackness in his speech from consuming too much mélange wine. The 12-year-old spoke in a firm voice before taking a sip.
May the wealth you display for us here, with all this food and abundance of water, be merely a pale reflection of the riches in your hearts.
The assembled guests endorsed the blessing, and Margaret detected a flicker of greed in their eyes. The planetologist fidgeted and finally spoke what was on his mind, as the clinking of glasses diminished. "Count Fenring, I understand you have an elaborate wet planet conservatory under construction here. I would be very interested in seeing it." Margaret suddenly understood why Kynes had accepted the invitation, the reason he had come in from the desert. Dressed in his plain but serviceable tunic and breeches, covered by a sandy brown cloak, the man resembled a dirty freeman more than an imperial servant. "You have learned our little secret, huh?" With obvious discomfort, Fenring pursed his lips. "I had intended to show it to my guests this evening, but sadly certain delays have made that impossible. Some other time, perhaps." "By keeping a private conservatory, do you not flaunt things that the people of Arrakis cannot have?" young Weichi asked. "Yet," Pardet Kynes said under his breath. Margaret heard it. Interesting. She saw that it would be a mistake to underestimate this rugged man, or even his son. "Surely it is an admirable goal to collect plants from all over the Imperium," she suggested patiently. "I see it as a display of riches the universe has to offer, rather than a reminder of what the people lack." In a low but firm tone, Pardet Kynes admonished the young man. "We did not come here to force our views on others."
"On the contrary, please be so good as to explain your views," Margaret urged, trying to ignore insulting looks still being exchanged across the table by the Akazi and Grumman ambassadors. "We won't take offense, I promise you."
"Yes," said a Karthag weapons importer from halfway down the table. His fingers were so laden with jeweled rings he could barely lift his hands. "Explain how freemen think. We all want to know that."
Kynes nodded slowly. "I have lived with them for many years. To begin an understanding of the freemen, realize that survival is their mindset. They waste nothing. Everything is salvaged, reused." "Down to the last drop of water," Fenring said. "Even the water in dead bodies, Kynes looked at his son, then back at Margaret. "And your private conservatory will require a great deal of that precious water to maintain."
"Ah, but as Imperial Observer here, I can do anything I please with natural resources," Fenring pointed out. "I consider my wife's conservatory a worthwhile expenditure."
"Your rights are not in doubt," Kynes said, his tone as steady as the shield wall. "And I am the planetologist for Emperor Shaddam, as I was for Elrud the Ninth before him. We are each bound to our duties, Count Fenring. You will hear no speeches from me about ecological issues. I merely answered your lady's question."
"Well then, planetologist, tell us something we don't know about Arrakis," the Baron said, gazing down the table. "You've certainly been here long enough. More of my men die here than in any other Harkonnen holding. The Guild can't even put enough functional weather satellites in orbit to provide reliable surveillance and make predictions. It is most frustrating."
"And thanks to the spice, Arrakis is also most profitable," Margaret said. "Especially for you, dear Baron."
"This planet defies understanding," Kynes said. "And it will take more than my brief lifetime to determine what is going on here. This much I know. We must learn how to live with the desert rather than against it."
"Do the freemen hate us?" Duchess Kaula, an imperial cousin, asked. She held a forkful of brandy-seasoned sweetbreads halfway to her mouth. "They are insular and distrust anyone who is non-freeman. But they are honest, direct people with a code of honor that no one at this table, not even myself, fully understands." With an elegant lift of her eyebrows, Margaret asked the next question, watching carefully for his reaction.
Is it true what we've heard, that you've become one of them yourself, planetologist?
I remain an Imperial servant, my lady, though there is much to be learned from the Freeman.
Murmurs rose from different seats, accompanied by louder pockets of discussion while the first dessert course arrived.
"Our Emperor still has no heir," Lupino Ord, the Grumman ambassador, commented.
The big man's voice was a lilting shrill. He'd been drinking steadily.
"Only two daughters, Irulan and Chalice.
Not that women aren't valuable." He looked around mischievously with his coal-black eyes, catching the disapproving gazes of several ladies at the table.
"But without a male heir, House Carino must step aside in favor of another great house."
"If he lives as long as Elrood, our emperor might have a century left in him," Margaret pointed out. "Perhaps you haven't heard that Lady Anirul is with child again?"
"My duties sometimes keep me out of the mainstream of news," Ord admitted.
He lifted his wine glass.
"Let us hope the next one is a boy."
"Hear, hear," several diners called out. But the Akazi diplomat, Bindik Narvi, made an obscene hand gesture. Margaret had heard about the long-standing animosity between the Archduke Armand Akaz and Viscount Mauritani of Grumman, but hadn't realized how serious it had grown. She wished she hadn't seated the two rivals so close to one another. Ord grabbed a thin-necked bottle and poured more blue wine for himself before a servant could do it for him.
"Count Fenring, you have many works of art featuring our emperor. Paintings, statues, plaques bearing his likeness. Is Shaddam funneling too much money into such self-serving commissions? They have sprouted up all over the Imperium."
"And someone keeps defacing them or knocking them down," the Carthag weapons importer said with a snort. Thinking of the planetologist and his son next to her, Margaret selected a sweet melange cake from the dessert tray. Perhaps the guests had not heard the other rumors, that those benevolent gifts of artwork contained surveillance devices to monitor activities around the Imperium, such as the plaque on the wall right behind Ord.
"Shaddam desires to make his mark as our ruler, Fenring commented. "I have known him for many years. He wishes to separate himself from the policies of his father, who served for so interminably long. Perhaps, but he's neglecting the training of actual Sardaukar troops while allowing the ranks of his generals, what are they called?"
"Bursegs," someone said.
"Yes, while allowing the ranks of his bursegs to increase, with exorbitant pensions and other benefits. Morale among the Sardaukar must be ebbing, as they are called upon to do more with fewer and fewer resources."
Margaret noticed her husband had grown dangerously quiet. Having narrowed his large eyes to slits, he was staring at the foolish drunk. A woman whispered something to the Grumman ambassador. He ran a finger over the lip of his wineglass.
"Oh, yes, I apologize for stating the obvious to someone who knows our emperor so well."
"You're an idiot, Ord," Narvi thundered, as if he'd been waiting for any chance to shout an insult.
"And you're a fool and a dead man."
The Grumman ambassador stood up, knocking his chair over behind him. He moved too swiftly, too accurately. Had his drunkenness all been an act, an excuse, just to provoke the man? Lupino Ord drew a gleaming cutter-disc pistol, and with ear-piercing reports, fired it repeatedly at his adversary. Had he planned this, provoking his Akazi rival? Cutter discs tore Narvi's face and chest apart, killing him long before the poisons on the razor edges could have any effect. Diners cried out and scattered in all directions. Footmen grabbed the reeling ambassador and wrestled the expended weapon from him. Margaret sat frozen in place, more astonished than terrified.
"What have I missed? How deep does this animosity between Akaz and House Mauritani go?"
"Lock him in one of the underground tunnels," Fenring commanded. "Station a guard at all times."
"But I have diplomatic immunity,"
Ord protested, his voice squeakier now.
"You don't dare hold me."
"Never assume what I might dare." The Count glanced at the shocked faces around him. "I could simply allow my other guests to punish you, thus exercising their own immunity, Fenring waved an arm, and the sputtering man was taken away until protected passage back to Grumman could be arranged. Medics hurried in, the same ones Fenring had seen earlier at the conservatory disaster. Clearly they could do nothing for the mutilated Ekazi ambassador.
"Quite a body count around here today," Fenring mused. "And I didn't kill any of them."
He said to his wife, who stood by him.
"I fear this will become an incident. Archduke Ekaz is bound to issue a formal complaint, and there's no telling how Viscount Mauritani will respond."
He commanded the footman to remove Narvi's body from the hall. Many of the guests had scattered to other rooms of the mansion.
"Shall we call people back?" He squeezed his wife's hand. "I hate to see the evening end like this. Maybe we could bring in the jongleurs, have them tell amusing stories."
Baron Harkonnen came up beside them, leaning on his wormhead cane.
"This is your jurisdiction, Count Fenring, not mine. You send a report to the Emperor."
"I'll take care of it," Fenring said tersely. "I'm journeying to Kaitain on another matter, and I will provide Shaddam with the necessary details and the proper excuses."
In the days of old Terra, there were experts in poisons, deviously clever persons who dealt in what were known as the powders of inheritance. Film book excerpt, Royal Library of Kaitain. Grinning with pride, Court Chamberlain Billy Redondo marched through the doorway.
"Your Imperial Majesty, you have another new daughter. Your wife has just delivered a fine and healthy girl."
Instead of rejoicing, Emperor Shaddam IV cursed under his breath and sent the man away.
"That makes three. What use is another daughter to me?"
He was in a foul mood, worse than any since the struggles to remove his decrepit father from the Golden Lion throne. At a brisk pace, Shaddam entered his private study, passing beneath an ancient plaque that read, "Law is the ultimate science." Some nonsense from Crown Prince Raphael Corino, a man who'd never even bothered to wear the imperial crown. He sealed the door behind him and thumped his angular frame into the textured, high-backed suspensor chair at his desk. A man of middle height, Shaddam had a loosely muscled body and an aquiline nose. His long nails were carefully manicured, his pomaded red hair combed straight back. He wore a gray Sardaukar-style uniform with epaulettes and silver and gold trim. But the military trappings no longer comforted him as they once had.